All right. Something which I'm not sure if I said last time, but was going to say, and in case I didn't, I'll say it this time, having to do with papers in general, is that this is an IP theory class, not an IP law class. And therefore, although your paper certainly can discuss what the law currently is, the really interesting question is not what the law is, but what it ought to be. That is to say, the interesting question is, here is some legal issue. In terms of the ideas we're using in this class, what are the arguments for why this rule ought to be A or B, all right? Or what it ought to be, or what you think it ought to be. But don't think of it as if what you're doing is giving somebody a summary of what law at this instant is, but rather as if what you're doing is analyzing arguments about what the law ought to be. All right? That's sort of what theory, I take it is. I'm going to start, as usual, with questions about last week and then about whether you have any questions about last week and then about the readings. And I think I am then, again, going to go on to discuss some of the economic ideas that underlie the readings you've just done in the hopes that I can clarify things that aren't clear, and then we'll go on from there to wherever we go. So the first question is, did you have any questions about the stuff we did last week? The ideas we were discussing then, we discussed the idea of property rules versus liability rules, which is in some sense coming in the stuff you read for this week as well. We discussed the question of contributory infringement and in what sense contributory infringement was analogous to defamation law. That is the case where you have a whole bunch of people who you might want to sue against or on behalf of for small amounts, and you find somebody who's got a large stake and you make him a sort of a substitute defendant in contributory negligence or a substitute plaintiff in defamation law. That, I think that's how you can make sense of both of those systems. Discuss the idea of tie-in sales, why you didn't really get two monopolies by saying if you buy my printer, you've got to use my paper, and some explanation of why you might choose to do that, why companies do that when they can. And talked a little bit about the general patentable subject matter issue, what characteristics make it more or less suitable to patent, to have certain things covered by patent law, where really that's two questions. One is what characteristics make patent law work well or badly for something, and what characteristics make the alternatives to patent law work well or badly. So if you're imagining that the alternative is trade secrecy, you can see that trade secrecy is going to work much less well for a product than it is for a process. Because the process, with luck, you can conduct only in your own factory, or maybe a few other companies that have signed agreements to keep it secret, whereas if you're making a product and selling it to 100,000 people, any one of them can disassemble the thing and figure out how it works. So that would be one example where you might, of the kind of question you might think about why alternatives to might work better in some areas than in others. Similarly, I think I may have mentioned in the copyright rather than the patent case, the fact that a little over 100 years ago, British authors got sizable royalties for U.S. sales, even though they had no copyright protection. And the reason was that the technology at the time had a large first mover advantage for printing, that it was time consuming and expensive to set type. A lot of the sales of a book are in the first few weeks after it comes out, so therefore the authorized publisher who got the manuscript before it was published in England was in a position that to have books ready to sell at the point when the pirate started his operation and therefore could make piracy unprofitable. So those are all sort of interesting issues to think about in this whole general issue of intellectual property. All right, so did any of you have any questions on that stuff? Yes.
About the more, but it was kind of, we're talking about evidence,
right? Yes.
Like one of the readings, this is at the university, kind of discussed all sorts of things. And then at the end, he said, well, we don't really know for sure. We'll just skate the course.
State what?
We'll just skate with what we have, the status quo. Because
yeah.
It doesn't turn out too many problems. And so that kind of made me think about. You know, we can discuss all these sorts of things, all these different forms of I mean, rules, but at the end, how are we going to get some more, I guess, hard evidence that would have been better?
Yeah, very hard. That is, I think the The book Against Intellectual Monopoly maybe may give you the best examples of that, because they at least try to argue here are various areas which first weren't patentable and then were, and what you can see about the rate of development before and after. So that gives you a little evidence. I guess you get a little evidence from the 19th century countries that didn't have patents, but not very much, because they could free ride, presumably, on discoveries by other people. Not sure what else. I mean, I don't think you're ever going to get evidence in the sense of here is a rigorous proof of what we should have, which is one reason why I'm one of the only people in the world who is a neutral on the intellectual property battle. That is to say, I think there are arguments for it and against it, rather than either thinking it's generally good or generally bad. So I think you do get evidence of all of that sort, but, you know, it's not like you're going to convict somebody. The other comments, questions? Yes. Sure. But prospect theory is saying that in addition to reward, that reward is one argument for giving out a claim to a prospector or a patent to an inventor. But a second argument is to say that converting this into private property then makes it possible to manage it better. So if you think about commons versus property, all right. Suppose you have a big field where you're thinking about growing wheat. And one option is anybody who wants can plant wheat there, anybody who wants can harvest wheat, including the wheat somebody else planted. That's going to work much less well than if that field belongs to one person, and that person can then either sell pieces of it or hire people to do it and so forth. So the argument that Kitch is making is that giving a patent, in addition to providing a reward for discovering something, also means there is now an owner who is in a position to coordinate further research. So the eyes, and a good deal of our reading for this time was really people critiquing that argument. So Kitch, in a sense, carried the argument one step further, that the previous argument saw the advantage of patent as being a reward for invention, and the disadvantage being raising the cost and, to users, and therefore a inefficient monopoly pricing of it, and the trade-off between those two. And Kitch says, well, actually, the monopoly pricing, the monopoly arrangement might be a benefit rather than a cost, because the monopoly firm, while it's true he will charge prices that are above the optimal efficient price, it's also true that he's in a position to say to other researchers, look, who wants to develop the idea in this way? Well, there's no point in having three of you working on the same project. He will do it. I will license him. You two do something else. And there are a variety of other things you can imagine. If you think about you have an invention, the invention produces a new kind of product. In order to sell the product, you've got to do various marketing activities. If anybody else can make the same product, then no firm has an incentive. What you actually see quite commonly is that firms advertise a characteristic of a product pretending it's special to them, when in fact it's true of everybody. All right? Why do they do that? Because there's no point to advertising that everybody's beer comes from springs of pure water or whatever it is, because then that's doing as much good for your competitors as for you. So the argument is, if I had a monopoly on beer, suppose there is in fact evidence that alcohol consumption at a low level is good for your health. Whether it's true, I'm not sure. I've seen some arguments, but at least if you just do sort of, when you see news stories about things being good or bad for your health, what they are often coming from is somebody has done a massive statistical study. You get 100,000 doctors to keep track of what they eat, and then you watch what happens to them. And then you report the doctors who ate meat were 10% more likely to have heart attacks than the doctor didn't, or something like that. You shouldn't take any of this very seriously, because the problem with that kind of uncontrolled experiment is that there is some reason why some doctors ate meat and some didn't. And it might be that the ones who didn't eat meat were ones who were careful about their health in other ways, and that's the cause of the effect. Similarly, the apparently there are multiple such studies which show that high levels of alcohol consumption are bad for your health and low levels are good, or better than none. That's the claim. And one explanation I saw that somebody offered for this is that what's really going on is the people who consume no alcohol are likely to be recovering alcoholics who are going cold turkey. They have bad health outcomes because of, but then the statistics just says, well, look, here are people who consume no alcohol, dying like flies, low level of alcohol must be good for you. All right. So that's a problem with that kind of study. Anyway, that's a digression. But the basic point I'm making is that Kitch's argument is that there are actually advantages to having somebody own the idea. Just as there is an advantage to having somebody own the rights to mining silver in some noticeable area, because if he didn't, once he sinks one shaft, somebody else is going to go next to it and sink another shaft to get at another part of that vein. Right. Interesting case, by the way, in terms of the problems with defining property rights. How would you define property rights in minerals back before you had technology that would tell you where you were underground? All right, suppose I'm mining silver, and suppose the claim says, yep, you've got this square mile. How do I know when I'm out, underneath, as I mine the silver, how do I know when I'm out of that square mile? And would that be the right way to do it? Given that if it's by a square mile, then somebody who can figure out where my vein is going and say, aha, I can free ride on his finding the vein, I'll dig a shaft a mile and 10 feet beyond his territory out and follow it. The answer I understand in the 19th century is that the claim was to the vein, not to the area. So that what was basically going on is that I discover silver. As long as I'm following that vein of silver, it's mine. Now, if you have separately discovered it 15 miles off, we might meet in the middle, and this much is mine and this much is yours. But as long as I'm following the vein, it's within my claim. So that was a different way of defining property rights, coming out of the issue of what you knew. And they didn't have GPSs. And even if they had, it might still be the right answer, because the relevant information is not, is this close to where I found silver, but is this where the silver is? Because I gather it was in veins, that is, you know, here and then here and then here, not just randomly distributed. Anyway, sort of interesting subject. So, other questions, comments? All right, how about the reading? You were really asking partly about the reading for this time, but other questions on the reading for this week? All right, let me then discuss a problem which runs through a whole lot of areas other than this. And in fact, I'm going to start by discussing an entirely different context. And that's the problem of joint causation. And let me go back a step to say, what are we trying to do in setting up our IP rules, at least from the economist standpoint? And the answer is that we would like everything to be invented that is worth inventing, every book to be written that is worth writing, where worth it means the value to those who benefit from it is greater than the cost to those who produce it. And furthermore, we'd like to have everything invented in the least costly way, so that on the whole, if Team A is going to get an invention, it's a waste for Team B to be trying the same project and get there a month later. All right? So ideally, I'm not saying we can do it, but if you think about what we're trying to construct legal rules for, legal rules that will give people the incentive to produce the right inventions in the right way. We're right in both cases. We're thinking of benefits ultimately to the people who use them and of costs to the people who are producing them. And if you think about it, there are really two different ways of doing this, conceptually different ways. One of them is to say, if you do something, you will get a reward equal to the total value of what you did. All right? And the virtue of that is that then anything where the cost to you is less than the value it will pay you to do, anything where the cost to you is more than the value it will pay. You may make mistakes, but at least you'll have the right incentives. This makes sense so far. But there's an alternative possibility. And the alternative is, if I know how much it costs to do something, suppose there's something which costs you $1,000 to do and is worth $2,000. Well, if I offer you $1,000 and $1, you'll do it. Just as good as if I offered you $2,000. All right. So if you think about it, if you knew the cost of producing something, then a possible rule would be a reward at least as large as the cost. Whereas if you knew the value of doing something, a possible rule would be a reward equal to the value. You don't have to know the cost, and then the guy who does it decides the cost in deciding whether or not to do it. And both of those are possible ways of getting the efficient outcome. Let me now come to the joint causation problem. And I want to start with an example that's not an IP, but that has to do with the economics of tort law. And I want to think about accidents between automobiles and pedestrians. And the question is, how do we give the driver the right incentive? And the right incentive means, how do we make it in the rational self-interest of drivers to take all precautions where the benefit of the precaution and reduced accident is larger than its cost? So a precaution might mean driving more slowly, it might mean not driving at night, it might mean having your brakes checked more often, it might mean not getting into lively conversations with the person sitting next to you. You have all sorts of ways in which you modify your behavior at some cost. You'd like to have that conversation, it's a fun conversation. And you want you to bear the cost only when it's worth it. And the simple tort answer is, we say, if you do run into a pedestrian, you must make him whole. Let's forget about the problem of killing people, which raises additional issues. But suppose that all injuries are injuries which can be compensated, and you would then say, all right, anytime you injure someone, you must fully compensate him. That means that all of the costs of the accident you're bearing the cost to you of your dented car and the cost to him of his broken leg or whatever. Since you're bearing all of the costs, it's in your rational self-interest to take any precaution that's worth taking, any precaution where the cost of the precaution is less than the benefit. Clear so far? Does anybody see a problem with this solution? The solution is that when I run into the pedestrian, I've got to make the pedestrian whole. Why is that? That gives me the right incentive, but what's its problem? Yeah?
Well, what if there's like contributory negligence?
It gives the pedestrian exactly the wrong incentive, that the accident is really jointly caused by the driver and the pedestrian. It wouldn't have occurred if I'd been paying more attention, but it also wouldn't have occurred if you had been wearing white instead of black, and I would have seen you 50 feet earlier and would have had time to slow down. All right? If you think about the normal accident, even though the law sometimes tries to say one party is at fault, sometimes it doesn't, as you say, in the case of contributory negligence, logically speaking, the result depends on decisions by both parties. All right. So if we say that the driver has got to compensate the pedestrian, then the driver has the right incentive, but the pedestrian has no incentive at all to take precautions. Because, again, I'm assuming you never get killed, so you're always going to be fully compensated, so why do you care if he runs into you or not? And this is the general problem of joint causation. When you have something where the outcome depends on decisions by two people, if you put all of the incentive on one, that gives the right incentive to him and the wrong incentive to the other. How might one solve that problem? Suppose the solution I'm thinking of raises other problems, but for a moment, suppose we wanted to give both the driver and the pedestrian the right incentives. How do we do it? Any really ingenious people here? Very simple. When I run into a pedestrian, I owe a fine to the state which equals the damage done to the pedestrian. And the pedestrian owns a fine to the state that equals the damage done to my car. All right? Double liability. Since the money is going to the state and not to the victim, it doesn't reduce his incentive. He's bearing the full cost of the accident, because he's got to pay for his own injuries, because he's not going to compensate, and he's got to pay for painting, repainting my car. I'm bearing the full cost, but I've got to pay the cost of his injuries, and I've got to repaint my car. Nobody's giving me the money for it. All right? So that would give the full incentive to both parties. Can you see some reasons why this isn't a very workable rule? What's really going to happen in that world? I knock down a pedestrian. What's the next thing that happens? Yeah? Yeah. The one thing we never do is to report it to the cops, right? Because then we both pay fines and nobody gets any benefit. So one way you could think of tort law is that one way of looking at it is partly a bounty system. It's a system giving the victim of a tort an incentive to report it, sort of like a bounty system for, you know, bounties for evidence on crimes. But in any case, but it does suggest a very general problem. And the problem then comes in the context discussed in your readings for today, among other places, in the invention and second invention context. So suppose I have an invention which produces a not very useful product. Maybe it's worth selling, maybe it's not. You have an improvement to my invention, and the improved version is really great. And the question is, how do we give me the right incentive to make the invention and you the right incentive to make the improvement? Can you see why it's really the same kind of problem? Because in order to get the improved invention, both of us have to do it. So suppose the rule is that that my patent is very narrowly defined and therefore doesn't cover the improved invention. All right, that roughly speaking is what's called the reverse doctrine of equivalence, the idea that even though your invention in some literal sense comes under my claims, it's so different that it shouldn't. All right? The doctrine of equivalence is the one which says even though your invention doesn't fall under my claims, it's close enough so that we will consider it too, and this is going the other way. But so suppose we define the initial invention very narrowly, and the result is that when you make your improvement, you are not covered by my patent, then you can make it and sell it all you like. What's the problem with that solution? Let's put it differently. What is the social value of my making my initial invention? Let me make some imaginary numbers just to make this work a little bit better. Suppose that the first invention is worth $100,000. If there's just that and nothing else, that's what I'll be able to sell the products and make the invention for. The second invention is worth $10 million. In a world in which patents are so narrow that the second invention isn't covered by the patent on the first, what is my incentive to make the first invention? How much am I willing to spend researching the first invention?
Up to
100,000. That's all I'm going to get, right? Because I'm not going to have any access to this 10 million. Right? So if it costs more than 100,000, I'm not going to do it. At least if I correctly count all of this. I hope it's clear that a lot of this discussion is making a sort of a full information kind of picture world to get a first approximation. So you'll know how much things are going to cost and how much they're worth, which is obviously not always true, as we'll come to later. Suppose the second invention actually costs $1 million to make. That's the research cost for making the second invention. What's the social value? What's the social value? Not the primary. What's the social value of the first invention without which the second invention can't be made? Anybody? How much better off is the world if I make that first invention? Yep.
$10,100,000.
$9,100,000. You're leaving out the cost of making this. Right. But the answer is the first invention. First, it produces a $100,000 benefit directly. Second, at a cost of $1 million, it produces $10 million. So that's a net gain of $9 million. So the total value of making the first invention is $9,100,000. People follow that argument? But I'm not going to do it unless I can make it do it for less than $100,000. So I'm not getting it. All right. Makes sense. So therefore, the narrow patent my incentive for the first invention equals 100,000. Suppose we do it the other way. Suppose what we say is that we have a broad patent and the second invention is going to be covered under the first patent. So the second inventor can't do anything unless the first invention happens. Now, how much money can the first inventor expect to get from his invention? With luck, assuming he's a good bargainer. Well, one possible is he makes the second invention himself. If he does that, how much does he get by making the first and second invention? What?
All of it.
Which is 9.1, right? He gets $9,100,000, so he's got to spend $1 million on the second invention, so he gets a net gain of $9,100,000. So if the first invention costs anything less than $9,100,000, he does it. Right answer. Right answer. That's what we want. On the other hand, let us suppose in that world that the first inventor is not the one who's going to make the second invention. The second invention is going to occur to a different person who knows different things, has different ideas, and so forth. What's the incentive for the second inventor to make his second invention after the first invention has been made and patented and the patent covers the second invention? That's right. We don't know the answer. And the answer is he could do as... I want to take this cost off because we're going to be playing with different values of it. So the answer is that it could be that this guy is a really tough marketer, and this guy is going to sit back and wait until the second invention is made. And he'll say, huh, you've got an invention from which you can make $10 million with my permission. I'll take 9.5 of it. All right? Might work, might not work. It's obviously going to be a bilateral monopoly bargain because the second guy also gets a patent after all, so the first guy can't use the second guy's invention without it. But what's pretty clear is the second inventor is quite unlikely to get $10 million. All right, you're going to have some division of this gain depending on the bargaining between the first and the second inventor. Consequently, if the cost is larger, suppose the cost is $8 million or $7 million, it may never pay him to make that invention. So the same rule that gives the guy the right to recover incentive for the first invention, supposing the second invention is going to be made, also undercuts the incentive to make the second invention. All right. So that's the basic problem which is running through some of the discussion in the book, which I think may... Am I right in assuming this was not all transparent to people reading the book? Yes, no. Did it? Was it obvious to everybody that this was the problem? No, that's what I thought. So I thought it was worth going through it because the... Part of the problem, I think, with the book, and I'm not sure it's a soluble problem, is that they're giving you readings from journal articles mostly. Well, journal articles are really people who are already in the field. So anyone who is reading the Journal of Law and Economics ought to understand the sort of basic economic arguments, should have seen this stuff 10 different times in the past. Johnny took my law and econ class, he would have seen it before. So that's part of the reason I'm trying to fill in the stuff that you can't really be expected to know because you're not professionals in the field, at least not yet. Most of you will never be professionals in this particular bit of the field, which some of you will. So we've got a problem here. And how can we solve that problem? One solution. Let's suppose that in fact it costs $7 million to develop this. And suppose that the first inventor somehow knows this. Suppose the first inventor has got his patent, which he's losing money on so far because it's cost him more than $100,000 to make, but he says, you know, I bet that guy over there who's really good at such and such could give me an improved version. Or maybe the guy over there comes to me and says, look, I can make your thing work. What's the obvious solution at this point? What do I, as the first inventor, do? I go to the second inventor and I say, look, I'm willing to pay you more than $7 million if you make the invention. Not the whole $10 million, of course. I want something out of this, too. This is going back to my point that one way of getting the efficient outcome is to have a reward equal to the value of what's produced. A different one is to have, for those things worth producing, a reward more than the cost of doing it. So you can imagine the bargain agreement between the first inventor and the second inventor, where the first inventor just hires the second inventor, says, look, I'll pay the $7 million cost, you got a new job. Or he says, you're a different firm, you don't want to work for me, nobody wants to be an employee if they can help it. Is that true, I wonder? Huh, let me take a poll. How many of you, in terms of your ideal future for future career, would prefer to be the employee of a firm? Say a law firm in your case, and how many would prefer, assuming you could do it, to be an independent freelance, so to speak? All right. It's an interesting question because it's a decision you will be in a position to make at various points in your life. But I'm thinking partly because my daughter, who just graduated from college, wants to make a career as an online freelance editor. And I have a good deal of sympathy with her that I certainly... I remember my wife's comment on when she was a geologist working for Shell, where she didn't really like going to work 2 hours before she woke up. Also, that she had 4 bosses over the time she worked for Shell, and 2 of them were competent, 2 of them weren't. So I can certainly see a sympathy. At the same time, of course, the problem with being a freelancer, you've got to run everything yourself, Whereas if you're in a firm, somebody else is taking care of marketing your services, someone else is making sure the copier works, and so forth and so on. So there are advantages both ways. But I'm sort of, my elder son, I remember commenting a long time ago that he thought people of his, sort of his generation or his group of people, he ended up working at Google, see life in terms of projects rather than careers. That instead of seeing it as, I'm going to spend my lifetime doing such and such, well, I'm going to do such and such, like another year or two. And after that, I'll find something else I can do. Which is, again, sort of, I'm not sure if he's right. It may apply to, he graduated from Harvey Mudd, which, as you may know, is a very high-techy kind of school. It's sort of a smaller Caltech, as it were. And I'm not sure, but it is, again, an interesting, different perspective on life. Well, I sympathize with it a good deal. In the world where you can have successful competition, successful contracting, then we solve the problem in that way. But it's not clear how reliable a picture of the world that really is, because after all, let's suppose that what actually happens, imagine that it's the second inventor who comes up with this brilliant idea for a great improvement in the invention. And he goes to the first inventor and he says, I've got a brilliant idea for a great improvement in your invention, and I would like to get you to get a license from you now where you agree to charge me only $1 million for the license, because that's going to be enough so it'll pay me to make my invention. So what do you, the first inventor, say? Before you reach any agreement, what would you like to know? Yeah? Yeah, which is going to require, what you're telling me, what else? I'm not just going to believe you when you give me a number. What am I going to want you to tell me?
What's your invention?
What's your invention? And what do I do after you tell me what your invention is? I made it. What do I need you for? All right. So there's a problem here. Same kind of problem you get with trade secret, which is, how do you contract over things without giving away the information that's the secret, that's the valuable thing that you're holding? So you can see why, although this is a logically possible way of doing things, it runs into fairly serious practical problems in terms of actual contracting. So let me go back a step and see if I can make the general argument that we're doing in three steps, with Kitsch as the middle step. And we're going to start out with something that we're going to be talking about, I'm not sure if it's Thursday or next week, but in the sort of the next reading thing, which is the work of Ronald Coates, who, by the way, died yesterday, unfortunately, at 102, so he had a good life. And Coates was looking at the equivalent of my auto pedestrian case, although he was looking more at cases such as a cattle rancher whose cattle trample the neighboring farmers' wheat fields. And there was a solution everybody knew to this problem, which was the equivalent of my make the driver liable for the damages to the pedestrian, and Coates pointed out the dual causation problem. And One part of Coates' argument was pointing out that the standard solution didn't in general work for the reason I've just ran through in the simple case. But the next point was to point out that if the two parties could contract with each other, and if you have the kind of simple world where any contract worth making gets made, then they would always solve the problem. That if it was cheaper for the farmer to fence his cattle in, farmer would fence his cattle in. If it was cheaper for the rancher to fence his cattle in, it was cheaper for the farmer to fence the cattle out, he would do it. They would just bargain until they reached the efficient outcome. Similarly here, if you think about the general problem of how you get all the right things done via invention, in what we sometimes refer to as a perfect Coasean world, not that Coase thought that world existed, where there are zero transaction costs, you could even get the perfect outcome with no intellectual property rights at all. What happens? Well, I say, I've got this idea for an invention I'd like to make. That if I make it with all intellectual property rights, everybody else will copy it, and it'll be available cheaply. And it's being available cheaply means that you're going to get a benefit of at least $15 as a customer, and she's going to get a benefit of $12 as a customer. So why don't all of us bargain that all of you customers who, after I make this invention and publish it, are all going to get this great good cheaply, all of you agree to pay me enough so that it's worth my making the invention? All right, so if you imagine a really zero transaction cost world, you would bargain for the efficient outcome for everything. All right, because any time that there's a change in what we're doing that produces net benefits, there's some way of allocating that benefit so that everybody's better off, so we all agree to it. That's sort of the first approximation, and you can then go down from that one to the slightly more realistic one, which I was discussing here before, which is the case where the first invention, where the first patent doesn't cover the second patent. But in that case, one possibility is that, well, first invention does cover the second patent. You could have the contractual solution that the first inventor pays the second inventor to invent. And in principle, if the first invention doesn't cover the second invention, then the second inventor, if he could really anticipate all of this, would pay the first inventor to make his first invention. All right, I can't have the high-pressure steam engine until you have the original steam engine. For some odd reason, I can't invent the original steam engine. So therefore, I, knowing that I'm going to have the improved version that's worth a lot, will pay you to make the first version. So if you imagine transaction costs not as impossibly low as in my first example where you can crack with 100 million people, but low enough so that all of the sort of central actors can reach any mutually agreeable deal, then you can see that either with narrow patents or with broad patents, you'd get to the efficient outcome. All right? And then Kitsch argues that either the bargaining where the second patent guy somehow, second inventor somehow anticipates and pays the first, that's too hard to do. The bargaining between the inventors and all the customers is too hard to do. So Kitsch says the level at which this becomes practical is once somebody owns the prospect, once somebody owns the right to make all steam engines, now he's in a position to bargain with the second and third inventors and to say, all right, either I'll license you this on the following terms, or I will pay you to buy your idea and have you develop your idea, and then I'll produce better steam engines and so forth. So that's Kitsch's stage. And Kitsch is saying, furthermore, not only do we have the benefit that we can now get the efficient thing and the bargaining involved is something closer to something believable because there's one firm which has got an incentive to do all of this, that firm can also avoid some other problems. That firm can also make sure that there aren't three different companies trying to invent the same improvement. They can, if they're clever enough, say, well, look, the improvement's no use unless I license you my patent. So how about you three guys all get together and do the project together, or I'll pick the one who's doing it best and agree to license to him so you can avoid duplication of effort. Furthermore, not only can that owner of the prospect engage in all of that, the owner of the prospect can also do things like marketing steam engines rather than marketing his steam engine, which would, in a narrow patent world, be largely benefiting the makers of the improvements rather than him. So Kitsch says, look, by giving broad patents, we can solve a whole bunch of problems, putting one actor in a position where he has both the ability and the incentive to coordinate what everybody else is doing. Right. That's the basic Kitschian argument. And that looks like a pretty good argument if you imagine the world where the first inventor knows who the second inventor is, knows the second inventor has got this wonderful invention, knows at least roughly how much it costs to invent it, and so forth. Thinking of it in economist jargon, I say that works in a world in which all the production functions are public knowledge, in which everybody knows that you can produce this invention at this cost, and they'll do that, and so forth. That's not a very plausible world. So then we if we imagine instead, much more plausibly, a world especially for inventions, much more than for wheat, where you've got one idea and he's got one idea and it occurs to him that the lens that I developed for eyeglasses would work really good for cameras because he's in the camera business. And it occurs to him, you know, that lens could be used to make a solar furnace with which we could do industrial processes using sunlight. And it occurs to her, you know, that lens combined with this laser technology I'm working with, we could make a death ray and sell that to the military for $100 million and so forth. If you imagine a world where the kind of information needed to make the follow-on inventions is highly dispersed, now it becomes very hard for a future solution to work because of the set of problems I've suggested. That if you have an idea and you come to the owner of the prospect, first, how do you avoid giving away the shop when you tell him what your idea is? Furthermore, since he doesn't have all your specialized knowledge, how does he know whether you're right? How does he know? So that then suggests, what at least some of the people I think are arguing, that maybe the best solution is a commons after all. All right, the commons is the narrow patent world. I discussed this at the beginning about property. The commons is the way we handle the English language, where we say, you want to make an invention? Great, that's very nice. All of us can use it. I'll make an invention. All of us can use it. You'll make an invention. All of us can use it. And it's true that in that world, my incentive for the first invention is too low. That in that world, this guy might never make his first invention because he's got no way of capturing the downstream profits that are going to come after the second, third, and fourth improvements. But on the other hand, if these would never happen in the other world because this invention would never get made because the guy would say, if I make it, he's going to pick up all the money, so why should I bother? Then maybe the commons is the least bad solution. All right, so that's the basic sort of the guts of the economic argument that's running through a good deal of what we're doing. Notice also, by the way, another problem, which I guess I did mention in passing but ought to mention again because it's another important one, is the problem that if what happens is you've got a narrow patent, the second guy makes his invention, he patents it too, and then bargains with the first, the problem is that the costs of making the second invention are now sunk costs. He can't get them back by unmaking it. So therefore, this guy can say to him, you're going to make $10 million out of that invention, cost you some, make a $10 million profit out of the invention, I want $9 million of it. Cost you $7 million to make an invention. Tough luck. Not getting that money back. That's a sunk cost. Right. Sunk costs, by the way, are a very useful concept in economics and in life. The sunk cost is the cost you've spent in order to do something, but which can't be recovered if you stop doing it. So if you imagine that you are thinking of getting a job as a cab driver in New York City, and this is before GPSs, so part of that job, let us suppose, is spending 6 months memorizing the map of New York City so that when you pick up somebody, you know where to take them. And you do that. And suppose that when you decided to do it, you thought that being a cab driver would pay you $5,000 a year more than your next best alternative, and you decided you were willing to spend 6 months effort learning the map in order to have for many years thereafter $5,000 a year more. Suppose that after you learn the map, there's a sort of a slump in the market for cab drivers, you discover you're too optimistic, and you conclude that you're only going to make $500 a year more than your next best alternative. Well, you've made a mistake. It wasn't worth that six-month investment, but what do you do now? Do you say, well, that wasn't worth doing it, I shouldn't be a cab driver? No, because you can't get the money, you can't get the 6 months back, still $500 a year better than anything else, so you do it. All right. So that once the sunk cost is made, it becomes irrelevant to your decision. And there are two different mistakes that people make with regard to sunk costs in life, as well as, I mean, with a little generalization, you can think of all sorts of what non-economists mistakenly think of as non-economic contexts. I'm not sure that we really believe there are any such, in which the same issues arise. So one mistake with sunk costs is to say, it turns out that including the sunk cost, this is a mistake, so I shouldn't do it. That would be the right thing before you made the sunk cost, but not after. The other mistake is to say, well, I've already invested 6 months, so even though it turns out that being a cab driver actually is a little bit worse than my next alternative, I've got to get something for my 6 months, so I'll do it. All right. This is referred to proverbially as throwing good money after bad. All right. So that the right view is to say, before I make the sunk cost, count it as a cost, is it worth taking? After I make it, write it off. And its only relevance now is figuring out why I was so stupid as to make that investment when it turned out to be a loss. All right, and therefore trying not to make that mistake again. But if you think about lots of social circumstances involving things like courtship or moving from one city to another for some reason or whatever, both of those mistakes are possible, Right? One mistake is saying, you know, I've spent all of this time on this relationship, therefore I shouldn't give it up, even though I now realize it was a mistake. I lost. A different mistake would be to say, well, it wasn't worth that much time, but this is still a better boyfriend, girlfriend, husband, wife, whatever it is, than I'm getting anywhere else, so I should stick with him. All right? So that would be, as I say, it's not really non-economic. That's covered by economics, covers that stuff too, but it's what people who aren't economists think is non-economic. All right? Economics, from my standpoint, is the approach to understanding behavior that starts from the assumption that individuals have objectives and tend to take the actions that achieve them, which is what economists mean by rationality. And that can be used to describe imperfectly all human behavior and a good deal of non-human behavior. You can think of the economics of how birds behave and how mice behave and how genes behave, for that matter. But that would be another story. All right. Let me just stop for 1 minute to see whether any of you, since I've just gone over one chunk of ideas that hopefully are useful, if you had questions or ideas or things that don't make sense to you. Yes?
I wonder if you can have a broad patent system, and then you start not by anybody who can like actually help the patent, but people who are willing to pay for that. So like some big idea, they don't really know how it works, and then they just say, oh, the government auctions such an idea to the highest bidder. Then they organize people who think that would have actually.
That is one version of the kitsch. All right, one thing you might get from the kitsch argument, along the lines of the old argument on how they should have handled turning the public lands into private property, is that somehow the government defines the prospects, what they do with oil leases. All right, what do they do with oil leases? What they do with oil leases is not to say, you go out, drill, find oil, and now you've got a claim, which is what they do with silver. They do with oil leases is they say, here is a chunk of the public lands, we are taking bids. Whatever oil company bids the most will have the right to drill there. So you could imagine trying to apply that to intellectual property. It's going to be a little bit harder, I think, because it's harder to draw lines around it. But you could imagine saying, look, there's this sort of idea that people think we're going to be able to do called genetic engineering. Who wants to own it? And maybe that's too big a chunk. Maybe we can somehow divide, you know, human genetic engineering, plant genetic engineering, animal genetic engineering, and auction off each of them. And some firm that believes they can do a good job of developing that prospect buys it. So that would be sort of an interesting, putting it differently, you could argue that one of the problems with Kitsch's approach is it gives too large an incentive. That Kitsch's approach, not only are you getting what you've contributed, your broad patent means you're getting a whole bunch of stuff other people are going to contribute too, so too big an incentive, so you'll have patent races and work too fast. So instead, just auction it off, and once you own it, you can say, well, I'm going to twiddle my thumbs for a while. I think it's going to be another 5 or 10 years before biological science gets good enough to actually make it worth researching this, but it's mine. I'm not going to lose it from doing that, and once it becomes worth doing, I'll do it. So that would be an interesting alternative, which I don't think Kitsch ever suggested as far as I know, but you could imagine doing it that way. So in any case, all of these sort of suggest arguments about broad or narrow patents, but also arguments whether you affect patents at all, because the full commons version is the one in which you don't. Let me go back to a question that I raised a week or so ago after you had read the first chapter in Against Intellectual Monopoly, and that's why Watt didn't license. All right, that I raised that question then, but that, of course, is connected with all of this, because the Kitsch argument takes it for granted that once Watt has his monopoly on the steam engine, he, of course, will go to Hornblower and everybody else and say, all right, what deals can we make? Let's make the best possible steam engine, make lots of money for all of us, figure out how to divide it up so we're all happy. And yet Watt apparently did nothing of the sort. So then the question is why? And I don't know what the answer is. There are a number of answers that are sort of suggested in one of the readings. There is a branch of economics which I don't think has produced much valuable, but which is inherently interesting, called behavioral economics, which comes out of a book that I thought was very good and that I recommend anybody who wants to read an intellectually interesting book. And the book is called Thinking Fast and Slow by Kahneman. Kahneman was a psychologist who got a Nobel Prize in economics and I think deserved it. And what Thinking Fast and Slow is about is the mistakes people make. That Kahneman claims that there are a whole bunch of ways in which we can go beyond the rationality assumption. A whole bunch of ways in which people will make the following kind of mistakes. And he has a theory. That is, it's not just, it's a combination of evidence and theory. And his basic theory is that human beings have two different mechanisms for dealing with information, for thinking, as it were, which he calls the fast mind and the slow mind. So that when I look around this room, I don't say, that's a pattern of blue and white narrow stripes over there, and there's a black line that's sort of this shape, and some sort of pinkish stuff, and some dark stuff up here, and some dark stuff up here, I wonder what that is. Instead, I see a human face, a person wearing a shirt with blue and white stripes, wearing glasses, that's what this part wears, and so forth. All of that is background processing. I'm engaging in no conscious analysis to get the data in my visual field and turn it from a pattern of colors into a person there, a person there, a person there, a female person there, a male person there. None of that. I'm never figuring out how I know that, and yet you know all of that. Similarly, you hear somebody's voice, you know who it is if it's a friend of yours. You never figure out how you know that. So that all of that is the fast mind. The fast mind is processing all the time, very rapidly, absorbing information and analyzing it. And it doesn't do it very well. And the reason it doesn't do it very well is that doing it very well is costly. Doing it very well takes more processing power than you have available for the huge amount of stuff you're analyzing. So it uses rules of thumb, it uses all sorts of simplifying assumptions, as it were. Then you've got the slow mind, which is explicit rational thought. And so Kahneman's argument is, if you understand what the simplifications are the fast mind is using, you can then predict mistakes. And he then gives you some evidence on this. Part of the fun of the book is that you become an experimental subject, you the reader. That repeatedly Kahneman gives you a puzzle. He says, what's the answer to this question? And each time one of two things happens. Either you give the wrong answer, or your first reaction is the wrong answer, you don't think about it and you realize why it's wrong. And what's going on is that he's rigged these so they take advantage of various patterns in the fast mind that give you the wrong answer. So that one of them, I don't remember the details, but one of them is something like a woman, college student who is very much into environmentalism, goes to what's the UCal that's very green, that's a little bit south of here along the coast, Santa Cruz, goes to UC Santa Cruz, et cetera, et cetera. Which is more likely, that 10 years from now she will be an attorney, or that 10 years from now she will be an attorney specializing in environmental causes? Which is more likely? Yeah? Got to be attorney, because if she's an attorney specializing in environmental causes, she's an attorney. But the instinct people say is, say, no, attorney specializing in environmental causes fits the picture we've just been given. And the fast mind, instead of thinking through the logic of probability, is using what's a closer fit instead. All right, so that's sort of one of the examples. He's got a bunch of other examples. One of the things I found really intriguing, I don't remember if he ever makes this explicit or not, but his approach gives an answer to a very ancient economic puzzle. Goes back to Adam Smith, and the puzzle is the lottery insurance puzzle. Why is it that the same people buy both insurance and lottery tickets? That insurance looks as though you want to reduce risk, and lottery tickets look as though you're paying to increase risk, and why do you do both? And there have been various explanations offered, but his explanation is that the fast mind has a very simple view of probability. There are only three categories it's usually using. One of them is impossible, one of them is possible, and one of them is certain, instead of 83%, 72%, and so on. Well, what do you do when you buy insurance? You shift a very unattractive outcome, namely your house burns down and you don't have the money to replace it, from possible to impossible, because now you'll have the money from the insurance. What happens when you buy a lottery ticket? You shift a very attractive outcome, namely you get $1 million, from impossible to possible. If you don't think about the actual probability numbers, those look as though they're both games. All right. So that's sort of an... Anyway, I recommend the book just for fun. But going back, one possible explanation for why Watt didn't do it is something along these lines. Some Behavioral econ is the attempt to integrate these ideas in economics. And this, I haven't at least seen anything where I felt as though I really got any. I understood stuff after reading Kahneman's book I didn't understand before. I don't think I understood anything very interesting after reading Nudges by Cass Sunstein and his co-author, which was applying these ideas that I didn't know before. It seemed to me that using these to actually get very far is a hard problem. But nonetheless, you may say, all right, I've been thinking like an economist, rational people, any bargain that produces net gains, they'll make it. But that's not really how people behave. And so maybe Watt was subject to a kind of bias, a sort of a status quo bias, which says whatever is right. So Watt says, look, I've come up with a design for steam engine. I bet none of those others are really important improvements. Or just the bias in favor of himself. All of us like to think well of ourselves. Maybe what's going on, for all I know, is that Watt says to Hornblower, yeah, I'm sure that's an improvement. I'll charge you a licensing fee in which I get lots and you get a little bit because mine was the big idea and yours is the little idea, and Hornblower had exactly the opposite set of views and therefore wouldn't agree. So you could think of various ways in which one possible explanation for the breakdown of this is failures of rationality. Another one that's suggested, which I'm not sure I find as convincing but as interesting, is there was an author quite a long time ago who argued that firms don't really profit maximize, they satisfice. That is, that rather, maybe people too, but I think he was talking especially about firms, that rather than thinking of a corporation as saying, how can we get the best expected return for our stockholders, you want to think of the corporation as saying, well, we're doing about so well. As long as we keep doing that well, nobody's going to get mad at us, and it's not worth taking risks to do better. I'm not sure if it's an accurate model, but it's a possible model of behavior. And so you say, well, all right, so the first inventor could take the risk of agreeing to fund the second invention, but they're making their $100,000. You know, that's something else. So you could have a variety of different theories, and I'm not sure that any of the ones in the reading you had were ones that I found terribly convincing. But they do give you examples of the fact that you somehow have to explain why Watt didn't do what any economist would have told him he should have done, and those are possible explanations for that. All right, let me go on to what's really a different version of the same problem, but it's also discussed in the reading, and that's what they're referring to as the open architecture argument. So the argument is that you create the IBM PC, and you say to yourself, the IBM PC would be worth an awful lot more if somebody made external hard drives that worked with it, and if somebody made printers of different sorts that worked with it, and if somebody wrote lots of software that ran on it. And I'm really not, my firm isn't really competent to do all of those things. So what we'll do instead is that we will, instead of enforcing any intellectual property rights we have on, we'll enforce our property rights on the machine itself. But instead of either using copyright law or trade secrecy to control how it works, we'll publish everything. We'll say, this is the interface for the machine. If you want the machine to do this, this is what you have to do. This is the internals of the machine. If you want to plug something into it, this is what you do. And when we publish that, then a firm out there will make a hard drive that interfaces with the IBM PC. A firm over there will make software that makes a better operating system for the IBM PC, and so forth and so on. And what'll we get out of that? Well, funny thing, we are the ones selling the IBM PCs. Everything that makes the IBM PC a better machine is money into our pocket. All right, so that would be the model. Now, there's an alternative model, which is a model that Apple actually followed with the original Mac, and that is we'll do it ourselves. So probably none of you are old enough to remember this, but the original Macintosh came with a word processor called MacWrite. Pretty good word processor, right? The standard at the time, because it was essentially the first mass market graphic interface machine, which made it hugely better than what everybody else was doing, with the exception of the Xerox Star, which was not a mass market machine, which is what they stole the ideas from. And I think there were one or two other companies that at about the same time tried less successfully to introduce similar machines, but it's a really neat machine. Came with a word processor. I think it had a spreadsheet. I know it had a drawing program. All of this stuff was really pretty new at the time. It was really neat stuff. So what Apple said was, instead of charging for the programs, we give away the programs. They only run on the Mac. So therefore, that's going to raise it. We can sell them. So two different strategies. Both of them worked. So the IBM one, at least for quite a while, was working better than the Mac one. So that when the Mac was made, I think they seriously underestimated the range of improvements possible. For example, it had no hard drive. And eventually somebody worked out a kludge by which you could somehow squeeze a hard drive inside the case of the Mac, which you weren't supposed to do, and that was a successful product, made Apple money, even though Apple didn't have it. But Apple was, in a sense, trying to discourage that, because their theory, I think, was the appliance theory. What they were saying was, if there are a bunch of different this's and that's and so forth, it's going to be too complicated a machine for the ordinary non-techie to use, so we want to control how everything happens. And they more or less followed that for a long time to varying degrees. There was a brief period when Apple allowed clones of the Macintosh, and then they stopped doing that. And again, I think part of their theory, it's another interesting question which I don't know enough to answer, but you can at least argue that, say, the iPhone versus Android, though at the moment Android's pretty clearly winning, but the argument could be the iPhones are all about the same. They have a uniform interface. Android, each phone company puts its own skin on it, and so it gets confusing. So you've got a sort of a trade-off between standardization, which having a single central controller gives you, and lots of different people with different ideas being able to contribute to make things work. All right? So, in any case, so the issue that's being discussed, going back to your reading, is that the open architecture solution is the one where you deliberately make it possible for other people to add as much as they want. The closed architecture is the one where you deliberately try to set it up so they need your permission to do it. If you think about video games, all right, it's an interesting question, because one of the things that some video game consoles tried to do was to make it so that you could only put a game on it with their permission, so that you in fact had to license the game. And in fact, there was some interesting IP law that came out of that, because the question was, suppose the way I do it is I make my console so that your game, in order to interact with it, has to say the following 33-word sentence, which is of no importance. It's just a code, in effect. It's just like a key in the lock. Ah, but 33-word sentences, we can copyright. So therefore, we can use intellectual property law in a bizarre kind of way, use copyright law, to prevent you from making games that play on our console without our permission. Of course, if you want a license, then we'll be glad to let you do it. And again, it's complicated. One of the issues that arose there, and it's an issue different versions of which are going to keep arising through all sorts of game things, is suppose I make software that lets people cheat on your game. All right? Suppose you have a game in which you're being a wizard doing something, or you're a hero with a sword. And what I do is to write another program, which I sell separately, which lets someone playing that game give his hero a super sword, or give his hero an extra 10,000 gold points or something. Well, it's sort of a little unclear. Should the owner of the console be for or against it? You could argue, well, look, people are going to like that. But you could also argue they really aren't going to like that, because it's true that he gets that and does really well. But then other people don't like playing the game as much, because they say, look, I can no longer say, look how good I am. I got the following score, because people can fake the score anytime they like. This is related to the whole issue, if any of you have played World of Warcraft, of whether or not you should be allowed to buy and sell characters. All right, World of Warcraft, you accumulate experience as you play the game. I mean, your character gets better and better and stronger and has more spells and so forth and so on. And the question is it legitimate for somebody to develop a level 90 character and then sell it on eBay? The buyer can now start out the game at the top, as it were. All right? And it happens, I should say. My guess is that doing that is probably a violation of Blizzard's contract. My impression is that Blizzard, which runs World of Warcraft, tries to prevent this sort of thing with varying degrees of success. Why might they want to try to prevent it? What harm is done when people can buy level 90 characters on eBay? Who is worse off, if anybody? Any guesses? Help if you actually play the game or some similar game. Yeah?
Well, there's a couple of problems. First of all, everyone else feels
cheated because they've done all the work.
Cheated, and if that leads to them ending a subscription or feeling
that's one problem.
And then also, if they're having problems enjoying the game because people have purchased characters that they haven't developed themselves and aren't particularly skilled at playing.
And in fact, the term eBay character is the term you use for the guy who went into a joint raid with you and is thoroughly incompetent. Now, how could he be a level 90 druid and not know that? Well, actually, he's only been a level 90 druid. He's only been a druid at all for a week, right? Because he bought it on eBay. And that makes the game less fun for other people, because normally you can say, well, if you're level 90, we don't know if you're very good or mediocre, but you're not incompetent. You've got to know a lot of stuff because you spent a lot of hours playing this game with this kind of character, this race, this class, and therefore, and so forth. So it's an interesting kind of, but it's the same kind of issue we're discussing here, the advantages and disadvantages of centralized coordination, in effect, that to what extent Blizzard can or can't. And you could imagine, I mean, in some ways, it would be, I guess you could say that Second Life is the extreme in the other direction. The Second Life is designed to let the players create their own stuff. And you could certainly, I mean, my main objection to World of Warcraft, mine and the other three members of my, well, two members of my family who still play and one, my son stopped playing after a while, is that we don't like the plot. That the people who write World of Warcraft, their basic plot idea is anytime things are really going well, create a catastrophe and smash everything. And that, after a while, gets sort of irritating. So you could imagine somebody coming up with something like that, deliberately designed to be much more nearly open source, so that you could, as it were, make your part of the plot over here and his part of the plot over there and so forth. And some of that happens even in World of Warcraft because people are ingenious about what they do, but it could be a lot more conceivably. Where was I? Oh, yes. I was talking about the question of open architecture. Now the problem which is raised with regard to open architecture is the argument that the people who make the add-ons have too low an incentive. Because with the open architecture story, then with the closed architecture story, presumably Apple can hire people to write McWrite. With the open architecture story, when Lotus creates a spreadsheet, Lotus 123, that makes the Microsoft, that makes the IBM, actually not Microsoft, the IBM PC more valuable, and that is a benefit to IBM, which means that Lotus has a lower incentive than they should to write the software, and therefore you might have software that was worth writing if you included the benefit to the people who control the platform, but isn't worth writing if you don't include it. So that's the argument. And again, that says, well, central coordination with sufficiently wise people, you do what Apple did. You hire somebody to write the software yourself, but it just might never occur to them that there is something else which hasn't occurred and would really make the thing a whole lot of fun. World of Warcraft, say. They couldn't have done that on the original Mac. Didn't have the horsepower. Or the internet, for example, which you needed for. See, the real breakthrough, which I'm pretty sure nobody could patent, that World of Warcraft is a successor to, is when it occurred to somebody that human beings are much better at pretending to be human beings than computers are. And that therefore you could make a game that felt much more like a real world if instead of having one human being and a whole lot of computer-generated characters, you had 10,000 human beings and a whole lot of computer-generated characters, and the human beings were largely interacting with each other. And that's really sort of the secret of games like that. And it's really a clever idea that somebody had and couldn't patent. But of course, the original spreadsheet, if you go back to the question of should software be patentable, if I was trying to think of a really clever, simple, elegant, valuable idea, the original spreadsheet was it. All right? Didn't get patented. At the time, I don't really know whether what we think of as the original one, which is VisiCalc, I've heard the claim that IBM on the mainframes actually had a spreadsheet earlier than that, though not one that was very well known. I'm not sure if it's true. If it's not true, the people who invented VisiCalc surely produced a $1 billion benefit. They didn't get it because at the time the doctrine was that software wasn't patentable. Maybe in some sense it still is, although as you know it's more complicated now. All right, let me go on to talk about another point which they discussed there, which is also sort of interesting, and that's what they're referring to as the anti-commons. Because the tragedy of the commons is the disadvantage of having a commons, which is the sort of standard tragedy. The common story is you imagine that there's a field, everybody in the village is allowed to graze his cattle on the field, it's a commons, consequently each person overgrazes, because when I'm deciding whether to add one more sheep or cow to my herd, I say, well, it's true, that means the grass will be eaten down a little bit more, but there are 100 people in the village, only 1% of that cost is going to me, the rest goes to them, so it'll still pay me to add another animal, even if the net cost of doing so is larger than that benefit, because the cost to me is less. That's the tragedy of the commons. You get overgrazing. Now, I should say, for anyone with historical interests, this is almost certainly historically wrong. That is to say, the term was originally used to refer to the English common fields. And as best I can tell, the English common fields were not much more common than a GM factory floor. That is to say, they had indeed rules about who was allowed to do what within the village, though exact rules I don't know. But it is in principle a problem. It's the overfishing problem, that if you have a situation where everybody's free to fish, each of them says, well, the more fish I catch, the fewer fish next year, but that's mostly a loss to everybody else, so therefore I'll keep catching fish and so forth. So that's a standard problem. That's a tragedy of commons problem. It runs through all sorts of different things. One could argue that if you have a class that's graded on the curve, and if the students are interested only in grades and not in actually learning anything, then it would be in their mutual interest to agree to all be lazy, to all go to parties instead of studying, because if it's on a curve, the average isn't affected, but there's a tragedy of the commons problem. Somebody's going to cheat, and he's going to overgraze by studying, and then the whole thing falls apart. As in many of these cases, when you're thinking of the logic of a problem, you don't want to be too concerned with whether it's good or bad. That is to say, the so-called prisoner's dilemma is a problem, a situation of the same sort, where two people act in a way such that they'd both be better off if they had acted differently. Now, in the original story, the two people are criminals, and what they're doing is confessing. We might say that's a good thing. But in terms of the logic, the same logic will apply to lots of other situations where we want people to coordinate. So, anyway, so the anti-commons is a situation where instead of saying that any one person can use the resource, you say the resource can only be used with unanimous consent. And there you've got a problem the other way around. So if you imagine we have a field, initially it's a commons, we stopped using it for grazing and started using it for grain. Now we have this problem that nobody does any work because somebody else will harvest the grain if they do. So we say, aha, here's the rule. You can only harvest the grain with unanimous consent. You only do anything with unanimous consent. And now the problem is that there's this wonderful crop of grain there, and I say to the other people, well, you know, I'm a real SOB, and I'm a tough-minded SOB. I think I should get a quarter of the grain, even though I'm only 1/100th of the population. And you know, if you don't give me a quarter of the grain, no one's getting any. It's just going to rot in the field because you need unanimous consent. All right, that's the problem of blocking positions. That's the tragedy of the anti-commons. All of the problems like that. And the place where that becomes relevant in IP is that if you have patents such that there are multiple patents, each of which is a blocking position. So if you imagine that in order to make a steam engine, you've got a license from Watt, because he's got the original steam engine, but you also have to license for Hornblower, because all the decent steam engines are the ones that include his improvement. And you've got to, and so forth and so on. So there are 10 different people, and if you have 9 licenses, you're out of luck. So then you have to worry about what happens when each one of them is trying to extract, as it were, the whole benefit. Maybe they can solve that problem, maybe they can't. As it happens, the first economics article I ever published, which I'm still rather proud of, was an economic theory of the size and shape of nations. And it was a model in which nations were competing for territory, and I was trying to explain what the equilibrium would look like. And one feature of it was the tragedy of the anti-commons, though I didn't call it that. Namely, you have a trade route. You've got multiple nations along the trade route, each of which can collect tolls on the trade route. And each one has an incentive to collect tolls that are too high, because the trouble with charging people for using the trade route is that fewer of them use it, but most of that cost goes to the other nations because it reduces the tolls they can collect. All right? And so the argument was that if the main source for government revenue was taxing trade, you would tend to get nations that were large and were oriented along trade routes, so that you had one nation doing all of the tolls along here rather than 10. So that was a tragedy of the anti-commons. And I just discovered last night that using Google Scholar, you can do a citation search on yourself. You can basically put in a list of all your articles, and it will show you for each article how many times other people cited it, and you can see who cited it. It's really quite a lot of fun. And it turned out my most cited article was one that was co-authored with two other people who were very prominent in the field, so I can't really claim credit. My second most cited article was the first article I ever published, the one I just described. I thought that was quite fun. Of course, you could say it means I've been going downhill ever since. But all right. Somewhere around here, there ought to be a copy of the seating chart, which I hope... I'm going to put it here, so anybody who hasn't noticed what's the front and the back, I've got it oriented properly, so if you just look at it as you go out, and if you haven't already looked at it, and make sure...